Barbara West publications include Full of Crow. That is like the coolest title I've heard in a long time. I was once in Meat Whistle Quarterly, you know.
Oh, well, I can't think of that.
Full of Crow, Brevities, Medusa's Kitchen, and Sacramento Voices, among others. Her first book was published last year by Cold River Press and is titled And I Felt the Simple Sweetness of Me. She's currently working on a memoir. She's a nurse, a mom, and a windsurfer. Please welcome Barbara West.
I'm just thrilled to have so many people here. I think I will use the mic some and sometimes not. So let's see how this works. Let's see. Oh, dear. That wasn't good at all. Hello? 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 Okay.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Let's give you some more cord.
Okay. For the first one I do today, I want to do a poem by somebody else. Patrick Grizel always does this, and so do other poets. And today I'm doing one by Katie Brown, who's right here somewhere. It's a short one, and she performed it just the other month, but I just love it. Zero by Katie Brown. The center of my heart knows all about zero. That moment between heartbeats, that small silence while my life gathers itself once more, repudiating the greater zero that awaits. Katie Brown. Okay, this one I recently wrote, and I don't think it needs a mic. Have a little more sip of water. Thank you. Some of you may not know that my ethnic background is Pennsylvania Dutch, similar to Amish. We're Church of the Brethren. It's an Anabaptist tradition, meaning full body, full immersion, adult baptism. And the nickname for our denomination historically has been Dunkard. Dunkard. We dropped the plain clothes 100 years ago, but it's still hard for me to wear patterns. Got my first ear pierced at 34, the tiny rhinestone in my left ear weighing so heavily I could hardly lift my head from my shoulder. I think of our ancestors immersing in the freezing creek at Christmas. As a child, we moved too often and always to a town with no church, so that I came of age without that ritual. But now I can see why I'm out on the water on the old wide board, 40 mile an hour gusts, tiny sail jerking crazily in my hands, caught in the tussle between the strong west wind and the ferocious north. I'm up and flying 1 second, then catapulting forward, slamming underwater. I come up smiling, blessed, joined, belonging. Okay, now I'm going to do a long one. This is a prose piece, but James said it was okay. This is from the book I'm working on, Hunger to Help, Sorting an Extraordinary Legacy. It's a memoir about how my Christian background and my Buddhist adopted lineage both teach me to help other people. But at the same time, I do 12-step recovery work for codependency, which tells me to focus on myself. So this memoir is about how I try to navigate that tension. And this is set not quite a year ago. I was doing a writing meditation retreat at Spirit Springs Ranch. It's a redwood tree farm in Mendocino. And the one person who lives there year-round is a man named Don. He's the caretaker. He's a retired cowboy. And his 26-year-old quarter horse has free run of the place. And he does not look like he's 26 years old. He looks like he's in the prime of life. Shiny, dark coat. He's a little grouchy and unpredictable, so if you kind of picture Eeyore, larger than life, on amphetamines and steroids, that'll give you a sense for this animal. Three Floating anxiety is the source of a lot of things, including codependency, or maybe it's a symptom. I've learned that one of the best ways to reduce anxiety is experiencing actual physical fear. Horse helps out a lot in this department. For someone so big and powerful, he's got the stealth thing down. Don says he uses his dark coloring to his advantage. You're feeling peacefully all alone in the world, heading out the cabin door, off to the outhouse again, when right at your elbow there's a vast snort and tromping, and then a half ton of testosterone parades by on the pond levee right in front of your nose. At a regular Buddhist center, you don't get much help in this department because the other inhabitants are things like deer and rabbits that are just as scaredy cat and polite as you are. But you stick around here long enough with horse sneaking up on you every now and then, and it recalibrates the nerves, dials them back down to a healthier level. This is my fourth retreat this year. It's November. I am fortunate. And it's not just fortune. This opportunity exists because I've let go of job security and regular health insurance. I knew the darkness was going to be an issue, never having done a retreat this close to the winter solstice. I'm afraid of the dark. Probably less so than most Americans, but most Americans wouldn't be spending 5 nights in a cabin, alone, in the woods. But as my sponsor says, fear will come in, that's okay. I'm so afraid of the dark that I don't use a flashlight. A flashlight narrows your awareness to that tiny pointing beam in the broad night, an easy target for anything that might be trying to get you. But I carry a flashlight so that if I get more scared, I have something to turn on. But I don't turn it on so that I feel I still have an option. Walking in the dark is very good for my prayer life, and here's where 300 years of heritage plus a lot of Little House on the Prairie episodes leave their mark. I may say I'm a Buddhist, but when I'm walking in the dark, I'm praying to God the whole time. What I didn't calculate was that this week there would be no moon. It's in the last quarter, so the tiny crescent doesn't rise until long after midnight. When it gets dark here now, it is very dark. In the past, I always managed to wall myself up in my cabin with my chamber pot, but this time the nights are too long. And with no food allowed in the cabin, I'm not going to make it from 5 p.m. till 6 a.m., plus the chamber pot could get pretty full during that time. Walking from the cabin to the barn, kitchen, and back, I navigate by looking up at the barely perceptible outlines of the blacker branches against the black sky. Everything from eye level down is indistinguishable. But as my sponsor says, if God takes me to it, he'll take me through it. On the last night, I have mercy on myself, and I leave a lamp on in the barn, a dim electric lantern back in the cabin. It does help to have something to shoot for, but now there's the problem of the shadowy shapes all around that were invisible on previous nights. In particular, off to my right, there's a big black shape as if the darkness had concentrated itself right there. I figure I'm imagining it, but even after I look away, this thicker chunk of blackness persists about 8 feet away. I remember there are remnants of an old wagon off in that direction and the wooden boxes for a horseshoe court, but this seems way too close. Maybe I steered off the path. I'm almost past it when there's a loud munching sound. Not toilets flushing, but just munching. It's horse. The miracle is that I don't scream. I've been afraid this would happen the entire time, and now it finally has. "Hi, horse," I managed to say. He keeps ripping up mouthfuls of grass, indifferent as usual. Then the munching stops, and the entire world is just blackness and silence. Was horse moving towards me? Was he just now inches away? Was I about to be sniffed by the darkness itself? Should I stretch out my hand? Finally, the munching resumes in the same spot, releasing me from these questions. This book is not Eat, Pray, Love, although I do happen to be eating. praying and loving. But instead of traveling the world, eating gourmet food, and enjoying romance with exotic men, I'm living in suburban California, taking care of morbidly obese wound care patients and raising a teenager. And instead of a happy ending where I'm with the man who's a very good lover and cook, this happy ending is more about making friends with my own loneliness and fear of the dark. A happy ending about feeling a little less scared when horse snorts around the corner, even if he still acts like he thinks I'm a bad idea. Thank you so much. You guys are an amazing audience. Okay. Now, I'm doing a series of local poems today. A lot of you have already heard my greatest hits from my book and stuff, so I'm like, what can I do? I'm like, oh, a lot of these people are from Davis, and it turns out I write a lot of poems that are set in Davis. I just wrote this this spring. It's called Sleeping at Hibbert's. It's a true story because I actually had this dream. Sleeping at Hibbert's. When insomnia gets tiresome, I pack up my cat, alarm clock, and comforter, and go down to Hibbert's Hardware. The sliding glass door in back isn't locked because no one wants these odd plumbing parts in the middle of the night. And once you get in behind the counter, there's a futon back there. Nothing soothes like the presence of tools, paint, and twine, where sleep comes as easy as the help freely given in the day from both sides of that counter. Okay, now I'm gonna do three poems. I got to perform in Oakland first week in May, so it's May Day week, and the theme was work and workers. And I was so excited about that theme, and I realized I've had a lot of interesting jobs. And so I wrote a little series of short poems. I'm going to do the last three, which are all set in Davis. When I was 19 years old, I was a laborer on the construction site for the Arlington Farms Apartments. It's a complex way out Russell Boulevard. And a little background for this first poem. It's more interesting if you know that my mother, who's here today, Marty West, is a retired employment law lawyer. Oh, and I'm going to do these three in a row. So this is like classical music. Don't clap in between. Girl on the job site. It was mom's idea to test hiring practices. Lo and behold, they hired me. Borrowed Eileen's old leather tool belt, which helped, but hard to pass with long blonde braid down the back and the still rising breasts of a late teenager. Mostly, I was alien, unregistered in consciousness. Occasional hoots, a little malice, some genuine redneck chivalry. I learned to break a banana off in chunks, not eat it whole from the peel. Oh, sorry, okay, next one. Break time. Quilted silver roach coach lurches onto job site, blaring Dixie. Hammers drop mid-swing, forklift engine cuts. Bruce lets the roll of Tyvek fall half-furled. We used to finish what we were doing, but now we know the boss needs to see us working in 15. Payday. My ticket to where sweaty torsos of all colors shine and press in close, smiling Friday, hanging on each name he calls until it's my turn to push through and claim that check. Thank you. Okay. Okay. I'm in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage, and some of you may or may not know that we've had issues lately with sexual misconduct acts being brought to life by some of our teachers and even our highest teacher. So it's a very difficult time in our Sangha. And I've never experienced any negative experiences like that, but I have felt how tricky the line can be for teacher and student. Teacher. That's the problem with spirit love. It bleeds over into everything else. Not that I didn't always have a crush on you. We were both safe because your big love for me was just like, almost exactly like, the big love you had for everyone else. I stuffed that jealousy for years. Even when it felt so particular, shoulder to shoulder on the porch swing, cracking hearts open wider again. Me always surprised, a little agitated, you at home in eternal surprise, living comfortable in luminosity. Then one day, I finally had your cell phone number, and then you started returning all my emails promptly. Your wife was always upstairs working from home. We made her an extra lunchtime serving. Until that day, she needed the house conference call quiet, so we met at Hungarian table for two, falling off our chairs, laughing, so in love it finally shone through the cracks in what we're made of. That dream of us on the white bed, slanting attic sunlight, antique rafters smelling of fresh wood, and in the garage where our work clothes kept coming off no matter how hard we tried. I would have gladly gone there. Just wanted to be sure she'd be okay with the subtle shift when you asked, what was I doing the rest of the afternoon? Could I be the great consort? Does she exist in present time? Could you? Thank you. Okay, parental advisory on this next one. I don't think someone was going to bring their kid, but I guess I scared them off already. Okay, so I have been making some videos by this Berkeley poet, Julia Vinograd. She's just incredible. She's been walking the streets of Berkeley blowing bubbles for about 50 years. She publishes one book a year. She has 52 books. I've never met her. I've never seen her, but my friend introduced me to her. She's my friend's mentor. Jan Steckel is my friend who hooks me up with Oakland Readings. And Jan brought several of her books to a reading and said, oh, pick one. So I had to pick this one because it's called America is Hiding Under My Bed. And I did a video of the title poem that I released on 4th of July. So it's on Vimeo and YouTube and my website and all that. But this is a second poem in here called Instructions for Soldiers Back from War. And it just kills me, and I just want people to know about it. And I was practicing for my friend Pamela early this week, and she said, yeah, obviously Julia Vinograd has had some contact with vets with PTSD, you know, more than I have. But Pamela also pointed out that it relates to any of us who, when we're persistently bringing past trauma into the present moment. Maybe I better use the mic. Instructions for Soldiers Back from War by Julia Vinograd. Do not kill the waiter who shoves a hot plate of soup too close to your face. There are no grenades in the clam chowder. Do not kill the waiter. Do not kill the fat man who pushes his belly and cart ahead of you in the grocery checkout line. His friends are not about to fire on you from the trees. There are no trees in the grocery, and the fat man has no friends. Do not kill the fat man. Do not kill the smiling secretary who won't let you in to talk to your doctor. The doctor is a very busy man. She wants to be a tape recording when she grows up. She's a large boulder blocking a narrow trail in the jungle. You always smell the jungle. Do not kill the smiling secretary. Do not kill the nervous people at work who talk about the war around the water cooler as if war were a football game. They expect you to kill them if a ghost can kill, and their laughter is all wrong. You spent years doing what was expected, but do not kill the nervous people. Do not kill your family who are not your family anymore. Somebody loved them, and you're living in his house. You know your gun better than your three-year-old son. You always will. Close your eyes in bed with your wife. Remember the teenage whore who tried to stab you? Your hands were always your deadliest weapon. Be polite. Sit on your hands. Do not kill your family. Do not kill yourself. It is a soldier's duty to stay alive, even in the land of the dead, which seems to be all around you. There's no taste to home-cooked food, but do not eat your gun. The enemy may appear at any moment. Wait for the enemy. That's Julia Vinograd, her book. This one's published by Zeitgeist Press, and there are 51 others, which I haven't even begun to look at. So, and I haven't even read more than a third of this, because the poems like hit me so hard I just had to stop. So who knows what else is in here. Okay, we're going to lighten up now. More Davis poems featuring local Davis businesses. This one is set partly at the Davis Barbershop right there on G Street. It's worth it to have a son just so you can go there. And JB's Power Equipment on Olive Drive, where you can get anything sharpened. Saturday, grass grows long, seed heads threaten to lie down, bangs hanging past eyebrow, cramp 6-year-old smile. Lawnmower has a short, long lines all week at the barbershop. Now it's Saturday. Borrow a station wagon, pinched fingers pull seat belts through crevice of back seat, dismantle mower handle for load in. While you're at it, pack in the neighbor boy with the shaggy blonde hair, the dull kitchen knives in a cardboard box. Just in the barbershop door, the clippers are buzzing, blonde hair, brown hair falls in fuzzy balls to the floor. The lawnmower guy unloads the mower while I'm standing by the tailgate wondering how to grip it. Pondering $3 a knife for well-cut tomatoes and a well-rested wrist. Boys sparkle, licking lollipops, white hairlines exposed, admiring shiny chainsaw teeth. Thank you. Okay, and here's one of my all-time favorite local institutions. It's the Yolo County Landfill. This is from a long time ago. Landfill. Isaiah next to me in his car seat. He's 21 now. Old blue tarp tied down over a load of bricks, stucco, chicken wire, cellulose insulation. Customs officials greet us at the gate. We pay our entry fee, $10 for a mini pickup with mixed solid waste, and pass into the wasteland. The sky is so blue. Brown grass perfectly covers smooth, flat-topped hills, graves for our wealth. Hawks hover. Rounding the corner with the 5-mile-an-hour warning, crows lined up waiting, barely distinguishable from bits of tires where they perch. Arrow guides us to today's disposal area, the busiest place. Our load ineligible for recycling, not pure metal or wood. Beautiful man in straw hat and reflecting orange safety vest waves us back in by the pickups and trailers. I unbuckle Isaiah to turn and watch the enormous caterpillar bulldozer. It climbs and descends the hill of garbage, tilting at alarming angles. Driver shows no fear of tipping. Later, he'll switch to the one with the round, spiked tires. I roll up the windows to protect Isaiah from noise and smell, slip the knots, pull off the tarp, wad it in a ball under truck so it won't blow away, unlatch tailgate. This is when the feeling begins. The carefree chucking of this brick with the right, that brick with the left, javelin throw with rusty nail planks, shot put another brick. There's a rhythm to the crashes and thuds as my dump mates and I unload, some a little wild, aim for leftover glass. All are rewarded with crashes and tinkles. This is the place where anything goes, burdens relieved, sins of greed absolved, toll of fashion laid bare in couches and exercise equipment by our bulldozer priest, forgiving, upending box springs like saltines. He'll take it from here, rejoining earth out of our hands and under the capable treads. Now, our little load is untangled. And if I remembered the broom, then I sweep along the parallel grooves, dig out the chunk in the tailgate hinge, latch it, empty and clean. Isaiah and I buckle in, and we're off, descending the mountain of dirt and God knows what. This is the last of my Davis poems. It's set at the Davis Athletic Club, when it used to be called that. Jacuzzi. Wore my good suit in the jacuzzi this time. You never know who might be soaking. Just me now, relinquishing to heat, turning to float up swollen knee, may it be bubbled clear. Temple resting on curve of cement, all soundness and rock, sinking in more, earlobe touches shoulder, and I felt the simple sweetness of me. Okay, this is my last one, and it's kind of long. It's from my new book that I'm working on, Hunger to Help. And this is a YOLO Hospice story. When I used to work for YOLO Hospice, like my colleague Ted here, who's our local YOLO Hospice celebrity. And I've worked for three other hospices, but somehow this story would only happen at YOLO Hospice. So my book is about how, you know, I'm always going around trying to help people, like my family and my Buddhist tradition, but half the time I'm ending up hurting them and myself instead of helping them. And the times when I'm able to help is often when it's not what I expected to do, and I'm actually listening to what is being asked of me. And in this case, I was lucky to be with somebody who was able to make a very clear request that I was able to hear that day. Sherry had been dying of cancer for a while. She was getting the hang of it. She lived behind an old house in a studio apartment facing an almond orchard. Her network of friends was poised to provide around-the-clock care, but it wasn't necessary quite yet. Her fatigue was getting to the point where it was difficult to watch her lift her emaciated frame from the bed. She couldn't eat anymore, but Satsuma mandarins were ripening on her backyard tree. Barbara, I have a favor to ask you. Feel free to say no. I was going to ask one of my friends, but people can get the wrong idea. Plus, I think you're someone who could really do it without feeling any guilt. Okay, I said. Ask me. If I'm not okay with it, I'll tell you. Good. You seem to be someone who knows how to enjoy things, really taste things. Would you be willing to eat one of the satsumas for me? If you sit very close and eat one right here next to me and really enjoy it, I think I'll feel it. I picked one of the satsumas from her table, a radiantly orange one, not dulled by any residual green, with the oversized loose skin, as if the flesh had concentrated itself after the peel had formed around it. It would come off easily, all in one piece. Sherry lay on her side at the bed's edge. I sat on the floor so that my mouth was at the same level as hers, inches away. I held the satsuma up near our mouths as I started to peel it. She reached out her hand and I tore off a piece of the peel, which she pressed to her face, inhaling deeply. I worked the rest of it free, elastic white fibers surrendering one by one. Then I held the naked fruit. When I started to separate the sections, she pulled my hands to her face, receiving the small sprinkling. I worked one section free right there and brought it into my mouth. I bit down slow, curbing my impulse to close my lips. This wasn't the time for manners, for containment. I closed my eyes to focus on the small explosions of color unfolding between my teeth. How we were on the receiving end of a telegram sent months ago by the Central Valley Sun, a time capsule that had perfected the balance of sharp and sweet, had collected what was best and sorted it precisely so that contamination could not exist. There was no room for anything still, blunt, or mundane. Existence became superconductor fluid extracted from both our lifetimes. I swallowed and felt all that trickle down my throat en route to remedy whatever suffered from winter. I continued with the next glowing section and the one after that. Whenever self-consciousness arose, I tuned back into the tang of nectar, exactly where it flowed, inside my cheek, under my tongue. I touched back to my faith in her request, her faith in me. This wasn't something I could do wrong. I finished eating it. She rolled back onto her pillow. That was it.
Barbara West. Stan. Now, both poets have books to sell, and Barbara's are on that table over there. Mary West are behind, Mary Zeppa's are behind you. After the reading, we'll stick around for about 30 minutes or so to give everybody a chance to buy some. I want to point out that Christmas is coming. Books make wonderful gifts. They're easy to wrap. You can mail them. You can get the same thing for other people and thus cut down on your shopping driving. Mary Zeppa is a poet, a singer, a literary journalist, and let me tell you, a fine friend over the course of like 25 years or so, too. She's been working with the Sacramento Poetry Center, both on the board of directors and doing other things since like 1981. She's co-host of the Third Thursday series in the Sacramento Room. That's that room that's above the Galleria in the main library in downtown Sac, where they have the really, really old and special books. Now, I went in there once looking for some stuff of Ann Minnebroker's, when she was still with us even, like a while back. And you got to be really cool in that room. They wouldn't even let me take a pencil in, you know. You can go in there and read and leave and be nice while you're there. But that's a series, correct me if I'm wrong, where you come and you, it's like an open mic, but you read other people's poems. Yeah, which is a wonderful thing to do. She has two previous chapbooks. Her full-length collection is My Body Tells Its Own Story. And it's back there on that table. And oh, if mine could talk. For 20 years, she was one of the a cappella quintet, Cherry Fizz, which I was very pleased to have seen myself. Please welcome Mary Zeppa.
Yeah, I always have to be prepared. It's thirsty work, like I was saying to Barbara before. It's thirsty work. So, let's see. I want to block everybody's face. I'd like to start my section of this afternoon with a moment of R-E-S-P-E-C-T, R-E-S-P-E-C-T for the Queen. And in that, to do that, I'd like to read a poem by Crystal Williams, called The Voice of God for Aretha Franklin. When she opens her mouth, our world swells like dawn on the pond when the sun licks the water and the jay garbles. The whole quiet thing coming into time, into tune. The gnats, frogs, the dandelion pollen, the pebbles and leaves, and the whole world of us sitting at the throat of the jay, dancing in the throat of the jay. All of us on the lip of the jay, singing doo-wop, doo-wop, doo. And because I have a lot of nerve, and because I was once one-fifth of an a cappella quintet, I'm going to make bold to lift my own voice. Hey, Stan. Lift my own voice in song now. I often say no decent tune is safe around me, because if I like a tune, I will borrow it and I will set my own lyrics to it. So this one is one that may be a little more obscure. It's called We Fell in Love Anyway, and it's by Mike Field and Naomi Martin. I came to it through listening to Rosemary Clooney on one of her CDs. Mine is called They Needed Me Anyway. I spotted the angel, his wings brushed the ground. He had forgotten his way around. I stopped to help, to offer my hand, and I caught a glimpse of a whole angel band. Truly they glittered, they brightened my way, but they needed me anyway. They needed me to tell them swing left, then sway right. They needed me to make way for their wings, brush back what clings, bear witness and sing. They'd all been human, the years went so fast. One final ride, they were making it last. I was their guide on that training wing flight, and we laughed our way through the night. I wrote that a while ago, but this is its world premiere. It's never been performed anywhere before. Thirsty work, like I said before. This is an older poem. My sort of mental outline for this reading is something old, something borrowed, something new, something borrowed, something blue. Well, most of that I can represent just by standing here myself. I embody all those qualities, but this was written after my husband Manny and I went on a photo safari in Kenya about 10, 12 years ago. So it's been around for a while, and I just, once in a while, you get out the older things and you look at them again and think, yeah, all right. So this has got a little epigraph, which is, an African seedling I hid in my suitcase, my pocket, purse, under my skin, dream. And it's in three parts, and they are numbered. I am going to read the numbers. An African seedling for Titus Mungugi Mungai. He was our guide. An African seedling, one. Raindrops dance your tin roof, my brother. It's your day off. You wake with a smile in your stone house 10 miles from Nairobi on 2 acres your smart father bought. On that slope overlooking a river, 20 contented hens cluck, and Hannah's seedlings, carnations, bananas, uncoil their shimmering stalks. The rain's rhythm moves up your backbone. Your toes follow not far behind, tip-tapping under the covers till they've waked Hannah, drowsy but game, as you scoop her up out of her last dream, sleep dancer through your living room, to the window your Morin leans out of to coax the rain down with her song. Two. We lifted our voices together, Titus, the brother I claim, who loves Dolly Parton and Mariah Carey, and hymns and the rhythm of grace. Titus Kikuyu, who loves Kenny Rogers, the gambler rolled off both our tongues. You've got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. As we stood side by side in the red dust of Kenya, that melody doubled and firm. Tapped our feet to Kenny's syncopation. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table, sang up the red gleaming sun. Three. And a pillar of fire lit the morning, and the tourists assembled and gazed. Some blessed the sky for its own sake, some offered heaven the praise. You did, O Titus, my brother who truly believes. Who's today? Who's to say? Someday he, old Jehovah, snow-white hand on his shimmering beard, just might glide down a fire-red sunbeam to let you know he approves, to tell you that your lives are pleasing, that he numbers the hairs on your heads, your Teresia, Damaris, James, Morin, and that Hannah outshines his own morning star. She is Ruth, Martha, Mary, and sings her own warrior left behind litanies, while for weeks at a time you are gone. While you drive the strangers with cameras down rough, rutted roads in your van, while you spot with your hawk eyes his lions, his leopards, his zebras, is giraffes, wildebeests, elephants, is aardvarks, impalas, hyenas, and sing out, like Adam, their names. Thank you. We really did stand there singing Kenny Rogers, in the and he does love all those people. This one is also about language. I guess all poems are about language in one way or another, but it has three Yiddish words in them. One of them is self-defined. Another one is Hamish, which means something like homey, and then there's Rugelach, which is a pastry. I have many poems whose titles elide into their first lines, and this is one of them. Esther learns mama lotion. Esther learns mama lotion, the mother tongue, from the last of the shy Hamish aunts, whose stories abide, hug her backbone, spill out in soft lullaby. Esther sings of their headscarves, their rugula, their bowed heads as the great rabbi passes and we spy just the brim of his hat. No one tells Esther much, but she listens. Which chicken is plumpest inside its white feathers, how to pluck them for pillows, for quilts. If a man casts his eye, she must not let him know. The heat of his gaze turns her rosy, loosens the strands of her braid. Just a hot look sometimes, you know? This is really old. I know it's really old because when I printed it off this morning, the address of an apartment I lived in, like, I don't know, 30 years ago, came off on the top of the page, but I still like it. It stood my test of personal time. It started life as a poem and then became a song. So I'll read the poem first, and then I'll sing it as a song. Kaleidoscope magic. It's all done with mirrors. My body in your arms, a breast or a hip or a thigh. At the edge of a circle, your fingers keep turning away and away and away. It's all done with mirrors, my body in your arms. It's all done with mirrors, my body in your arms. A breast or a hip or a thigh, a breast or a hip or a thigh. At the edge of a circle, your fingers keep turning away and away and away. At the edge of a circle, your fingers keep turning away and away and away. You are a wonderful audience. This is something more recent, and it is, I wouldn't go say like our friend Bill Gaynor, true story, but there's a true story in it. And it's another one of those with the title alighting into the first line. Tell me something good. Tell me something good, I begged Jenny, after I'd fetched a long while. I wish I could, she sighed, squeezing my hand. Turned out the coroner'd called her that morning, hoping that she'd claim the body of a man she used to love. He was handsome, a charmer, a drinker. Rehab after rehab, we lost count. Can't fix me, he used to crow. He talked such sweet talk, spun such stories. She took him back, took him back. Last straw was he wrecked the kitchen. Plates, bottles, salt shakers flying. She ran out her own back door. Wasn't long after that, someone spotted him in Wino Park, passing a jug. All right, now this is a leap, but I can see you're all intelligent, perceptive people, so I'm figuring you can make this leap with me. That's not really a segue from that last one. This is a subject matter I've been struggling with for decades, and its latest incarnation is called Dad Makes the World Safe for Democracy, Me and Mom Stay at Grandma's Sad Farm. Deep breath, yank her kitchen door open. Catch a whiff, chicken guts, sour milk. Pinched, prissy mouth primed for vitriol, she keeps us all on high alert. Loaded flypaper swings from her ceiling, dingy towels from the pegs on two walls. Two or three funeral home calendars still read January, deep into March, deep into April, May, June. Take a listen through wide open windows, hogs snorting, boss of the yard. Fat chance. Not on Grandma Anna's watch. She numbers the hairs on our arms and tallies her own disappointments, sons, husband, daughter-in-law. Anna still mourning her lost hopes, her fleeting 18-inch waist. Not even steel stays can bring that back. But they do keep her spine straight as she sneaks up on young Mary May and her pink and dimpled young brat. Who knows what fresh devilment we'll think up next? We'd blown the dust off all the Hummels, freed all the books from their shelves, Luther's small catechism, three Bibles, Struwwelpeter with his pleading eyes, with his foot-wide bird's nest of matted hair, with his black 18-inch fingernails. Struwwelpeter, devoutly bad apple, cautionary tale, brat, consequence. Wriggle out of a haircut, wake up in your own bed, trapped in your own knotted hair. All 10 fingers caught in the tangles, snagged by their splintering nails. I would startle awake, Grandma's red mouth inhaling my shuddering breath. She could wilt calico roses. She could scorch honeymoon bloom. Brown-eyed and lively, Mary May, Mom, hid away in our bedroom, while Grandma Anna shook her dusty head. Child has my son's blue eyes, blonde waves, but the dimpled face gazing up into hers replicated my Methodist mother's, flashed her catch me if you can grin. Is anyone familiar with Struwwelpeter? It was a German book. No one else's life was scarred by that. No one else's childhood was scarred by that. It's a rascally kid. He was mischievous, but there were these horrible punishments that that anybody rebellious in this book, and there were a couple of other characters, but he was the main one. There was a girl who lit herself on fire. It was very grim stuff. They just wanted you to, like, behave yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. So, if you find a book, burn it, I say. And I don't say that about many books. I think we need a palate cleanser after that. So, this is called Working the Day Shift in the Land of Nod. And it's in two parts. And they are based on actual dreams, believe it or not. These sound like too good to be real dreams, but they really were. Working the Day Shift in the Land of Nod, 1. In the first sleep, he came to me cooking spaghetti sauce in my kitchen, in his blue silk shirt. In my kitchen, Bill Clinton was cooking spaghetti sauce. He stepped back from the stove, his hands overflowing, my last three cans of whole Roma tomatoes, my last hidden bottle of Pompeian oil. His sticky fingers wig-wagging, new triumph, spaghetti sauce a la Bill. The former leader of the free world in my slate-blue kitchen, cooking spaghetti sauce and grinning like Patsy Cline. 2. In the next sleep, he came to me, Bill William Stafford, in a knit purple shirt and khaki Bermuda shorts. He peered through the rain and the fog and my window, peered with intelligent, ripe satisfaction. Bill Stafford alive, tapping on my front window, Bill Stafford needing to pee. I rushed to the door, glad to be of use, in my Clan Campbell nightdress, blue plaid. To the left, Bill, I said, as he brushed past, resurrected, resplendent, relieved. Ah. So I have a series of poems that have a character who's kind of me and kind of not me. She's called the Redheaded Widow. And I'm going to read, they're short, four of those. The first two, again, title and first line. The Redheaded Widow and the Honky-Tonk Angel. The Redheaded Widow and the Honky-Tonk Angel walked into a bar where all the drinks were complimentario, in other words, on the house. The widow called, "Bring me a holy smoke." The angel, "A great balls of fire." They shouted, "L'chaim," clinked glasses, and kept their eyes peeled for the host. The heavenly host, that is, halos, it was that kind of a place. By last call, they all looked like angels, the capital A kind, with wings. "Blow, Gabriel," yelled the pool players, but Louis and Miles got there first. Gabe was a good sport, though. He played along on Kind of Blue, Wonderful World. The honky-tonk angel who couldn't resist nudged the widow, who lifted her voice to hear that her wrecked soprano had, miracle, healed itself, to soar as it never had. Oh, mighty clouds of tender, abiding joy. The Redheaded Widow and I. The Redheaded Widow and I are like sisters. Some say we have the same eyes, but mine are changeable, green when I wear green, and hers a constant cyan. She is taller, too, statuesque, gleaming, while I am buffed to a shine. I am the aspirant, she the ideal. She keeps rocking the cold heart of darkness, and I the dead weight of sin. The Redheaded Widow knew only God loved her. Unless she was somebody's lost secret, somebody's lost love at first sight, left behind in a tangle of memory, that ghost he could almost hear whisper into his most silent nights. It's just thirsty work. I have one more of these. And it's in three sections. They have asterisks between them, so I'm just going to pause. The Redheaded Widow of Everything. She is tasting the absence of everything holy. There's no road that won't lead her home. But here, on the corner of stressed and distressed, her nerves sing that stripped by wind song. The shadows may swallow her and all her secrets, the ghost with the squat, upraised fist, the ghost with the sneer and the sheath knife, the oily begetter of ghosts. We have traveled forever, our arms full of sorrow, the Redheaded Widow and I. We take turns at the window to watch how they're living, the others along for the ride. Oh, one more poem and one tiny little snippet of song. I like to know what's coming for me, so I'm telling you it's coming for you. This is the poem that was in the publicity that James did. I am lucky enough to be part of a group of seven wonderful women poets. We've been together for a dozen years now. We meet every 6 to 8 weeks. We all read the same book of poetry and talk about it. And we look at each other's work. We give each other assignments. And we eat and we drink and we laugh and we cry. And it's pretty goddamn wonderful. So this came from an assignment by one of our number, Victoria Dahlke. Ai Weiwei's father, Ai King, was a poet, and he suffered quite a lot during the Cultural Revolution. That was news to me, at least. And so this is for Ai Weiwei's father, Ai King. The stars, my son, know nothing. The stars, my son, know nothing, though they first say otherwise. No one else can see the difference. Your mother's closed her eyes. This darkness is unholy, and its jasmine breath is strong. Beneath the river, secrets swim. One of them is my name. I can't say more. I walk away. The gods don't come around. It's not a gift, this seeing, this serpent in my arms. Believe I love you, and believe the rhythm comes at last. The deep lobes of the peonies, ah, they have the last laugh. Now, as I've said, I write a lot of lyrics to other people's melodies, but sometimes it just drops whole into my brain, and I don't know whether that means it's my melody or I stole it from the cosmos or just what, but this is one of those. And I've been lucky enough to have residencies, fellowships at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts 3 times, and this was happened the first time I was there. Just dropped into my head, just exactly like this. Guillaume Apollinaire waltzed in the plein air, cradled the man in the moon, whispering joyously, "Old man, you mean to me everything, singing in tune, everything singing in tune." Thank you. In the immortal words of the Beatles, "You're such a lovely audience. I'd like to take you home with me."
Mary Zeppa. You know, I like to think that poetry is kind of two arts in one, like a baseball switch hitter or maybe an ambidextrous outside shooter in basketball. You get the one thing where you're home reading it, where you're reading poetry, and there's the connection with you and the poet, and it's just the two of you, and you're alone, and you know, there's an emotional connection there. But it's something else when there's a bunch of us in a room, and you put the poetry in the air, and we all feel it, and a line comes out, and you feel it in here somewhere, and you go, you hear somebody else across the room, because you felt it. And you're not alone with the poet, because you're here with Stan, and you're here with Mikey, and you're here with Eva and John. And you're here with Charles, and you're here with Alexandra, and you share this thing, and this thing is called community. It's arts and community. It's a wonderful thing. I want to thank our poets and all of you for coming out and sharing community with me today.